BBC World Service now off the shelf, and we have the concluding part of With Billy, the racy life story of the great jazz singer Billie Holiday, as told by those who knew her. Julia Blackburn reads from her new biography, With Billy.
Smoking, drinking, never thinking of tomorrow.
The pianist, Bobby Tucker, first met Billy in 1945 or 1946. When Billy was introduced to Bobby, she asked him to play for her.
And so I went in. And when she asked for this or that, it was so easy because I used to play those things for kicks. So she felt relaxed, but then she's so easy to play for. I mean, she could find a groove wherever you put it. She could swing the hardest in any tempo, even if it was like a dirge. Whatever it was, she could float on top of it.
Bobby Tucker played for Billy for the next 4 or 5 weeks. But all that time, he felt as if he was stealing her money.
She didn't kill me at all. Not at all. To me, there was no sound. It was a flat thing. But then, Tony Scott told me how to listen and appreciate Billy's qualities by explaining that when Ella Fitzgerald sings, "My Man, He Left Me," you think the guy went down the street for a loaf of bread. When Lady sings, you can see that guy going down the street. Yeah, he got his bags packed and he ain't never coming back.
I'm watching the sea. Will the one I love coming back to me.
Jimmy Fletcher was a federal narcotics agent, but he was aware that in Billy's case, it was her fame, her color, and her peculiar mixture of defiance and vulnerability that got her into such deep trouble. After all, there were many others in the entertainment industry who were not pursued so remorselessly or punished so harshly once they had been caught. As a black narcotics agent, Jimmy Fletcher's main job was as a so-called archive man, mixing in the underworld to find out who was selling drugs and who was buying them. He got to know Billy through her husband, Jimmy Monroe. Billy told Jimmy Fletcher that she used heroin occasionally, but she was not injecting.
I never let it get me. I never let it happen. I can master it.
According to Jimmy Fletcher, the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, the FBI, and the local police departments had been keeping files on Billy from the beginning, and she was being constantly pursued by various agents who were keen to make a lovely big case against her. In fact, the FBI started their files on Billy in around 1940, after she sang Strange Fruit at Cafe Society. But it was not just the forces of law that were involved. As Jimmy explained,
there were also plenty of small-timers who never reached her stardom. And there was so much animosity between them. Entertainers have all got enemies. And there were people who'd say, "Why don't you catch that Billie Holiday? She's so high she can't sing."
There is also the complex issue of how addicted Billie really was. Few people ever saw her injecting, and it seems that whenever she stopped using heroin, either by choice or necessity, she always managed to avoid the usual traumas of withdrawal. On the occasions when she was under extreme psychological pressure during her last years, she tended to use alcohol to drown her sorrows. So why is it that the story of Billy's life has constantly been portrayed as that of a particularly hopeless drug dependency? Why is it that even the briefest account of her on the back of a CD cover or the caption to a photograph will invariably include a mention of her heroin addiction, although others of her generation who were equally, or much more heavily, addicted, are allowed to be cut free from the burden of their particular troubles? The long list of musicians who used heroin during this period includes Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, Chet Baker, and Stan Getz. William Dufty, the New York Post journalist responsible for ghostwriting Billy's autobiography, Lady Sings the Blues, had a lot to answer for. When he was drawing up his contract for the book, he agreed with his publishers that narcotics would be what they called the gimmick that would sell it. The chance to fix Billy's arrest and to be sure that she was sent to jail came in 1947, when her agent, Joe Glazer, decided that his client needed to be taught a lesson. It is impossible to know what Glazer's real motives were, but it is certain that he helped to engineer Billy's arrest. In May 1947, Billy was arrested, charged, and sentenced to a year and a day at the Federal Reformatory for Women in Alderston, Virginia. She was sent to prison when she was at the height of her fame. On her release, because of her prison sentence, she was denied her cabaret card in New York. Without her card, Billy could no longer work on the New York club circuit, and she was forced to take on a hectic schedule of performances, sometimes performing as many as 5 times a day, 7 days a week. Alice Vrubsky worked as Billy's secretary during the final 2 years of Billy's life.
I'd only heard her on records, but then in the summer of 1957 I got to see her in Central Park. I enjoyed the performance so much that I went up to thank her afterwards. She'd signed the program, and I was trying to tell her how much I admired her. I said I'd got the album Lady Sings the Blues, but I hadn't got it with me, and I asked if she would mind if I brought it down for her to sign. And she said, "Fine, bring it down." So the next day I showed up with a record, and the first thing she said was, "Ah, a woman of her word," just like that. And on the album she wrote, "Thank you for loving me." You see, we hit it off. I can't explain it, but we hit it off. Her husband, Louis McKay, asked if I would be her secretary. I was really surprised. I was just a novice. But he made it sound wonderful. I get to see some of the country, and I'd get to hear her sing. When I started with her, we went to Los Angeles. Her husband made arrangements to get us an apartment, but then he faded out quite promptly. The apartment was in a pretty lousy condition, and we were both scrubbing and wiping and mopping, but she did the major part of it. It was I who was helping her. She was a hard worker. She was a very intelligent woman who knew about many things. She'd say, "People don't think I like laughing. They don't think I lead any kind of normal life." I think it bothered her that people thought she was something peculiar, in the sense of being totally depressed and out of everything. She wasn't the kind of person who pitied herself, or if she did, it was only when she was alone. But she used to say, "I can sing in Carnegie Hall and in a place where they sell ice cream to kids, but I can't sing where people drink." She wasn't working regularly. She was working when she could. You can't live if you don't work, and this was her problem in the last 2 years I knew her, just finding enough work to keep ahead of things. For the last year and a half, she lived in an apartment in New York. She didn't really have any possessions because she'd been living in hotels, and so she wasn't somebody who could accumulate things. She had a radio, and she'd carry it with her from room to room. I used to mix her drinks. She smoked heavily, and she had a cigarette and a glass in her hand more often than not. When I was there, I tried to make her eat something for breakfast, but in the end she wouldn't even eat. By June 1959, she was mainly drinking Gordon's gin and 7-Up, and that was why she started losing so much weight. She stayed at home and watched TV, mostly, at the end. Her only bad habit was that she would often fall asleep while she was smoking a cigarette, and she'd burn holes in her nightgown or bathrobe. She'd make jokes about it and say, "I'm real holy." I didn't realize that she was as ill as she was, and I was kind of surprised when she was taken to the hospital. She didn't complain. She wasn't the kind of person who said, "I don't feel good." Maybe that's why I was so shocked.
When Billy was first in hospital, she had friends visiting her and well-wishers sending her messages. There was obviously a rather mad party atmosphere in Billy's room. Her lawyer, Earl Zadins, wanted to arrange a new recording deal with MGM, and Billy warmed to the idea, saying that they could bring the recording equipment into the Metropolitan Hospital and called the new record Lady at the Met. Everyone agreed that Billy had been getting better. But then, on the 11th of June, she was arrested in her hospital bed on the charge of possessing narcotics, and everything became much more serious. Everyone who was involved had a different account of what drugs were found and where, and they all disagreed as to whether Billy was clean or not. Zaidins was convinced that Billy's worst fears had come true and somebody had planted the drugs in her room. Detectives removed her record player, her records, the radio, and her comic books. She was refused bail, and three policewomen kept a 24-hour guard at the door of her room. Even after a writ of habeas corpus had been obtained, which should have got rid of the police presence, the police guard stayed.
When she was arrested, they only allowed so many people to go up and see her, and it was more difficult. Then there was the police guard outside the door. At that time, she was too ill to have gotten up and walked out. So I don't know what they were protecting her from, or for.
On the 11th of July, 1959, Billy's heart began to falter, and in the early hours of the 17th of July, she died. She was just 44. She had made jokes about it, being the same old Keystone Cops routine, but the threat of imprisonment then facing her contributed more to her sudden decline in hospital than the cirrhosis of the liver, kidney failure, and other medical complications that appeared on her death certificate.
She was bitter about the arrest. They took everything away in the hospital, even the hope she had. She did get flowers, especially when the publicity about her arrest got out, but it is an exaggeration to say she always had a room full of them. People who didn't necessarily know her, but who appreciated her music, sent her cards. Mostly these cards were from ordinary people. And that is why she didn't get flowers from them, because ordinary people can't afford that much, especially black people. I think then when she saw all the cards and letters, that really made her feel much better. Because she probably didn't realize how many ordinary people cared for her. And how many people she touched.
When things go wrong, perhaps you'll see you're meant for me, and I'll be around when she's gone.
Julia Blackburn reading from her recent book With Billy, published by Jonathan Cape. Bobby Tucker was played by Rashan Stone, Billy Holiday by Ali Parsons, Jimmy Fletcher by Kenny A. Andrews, and Alice Vrubsky by Kate Harper. It was abridged and produced by Emma Harding.